Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. It is Saturday. I believe it is September 30th, 29th. I have my usual date deficit going. In any event, the last Saturday in September of 2017. Thanks for listening. And by the way, thanks for the huge growth in our listening ship, our listenership, over the past 4 weeks, particularly. Quite remarkable. And, you know, pass this link on to as many folks as you can. Because we have information, I think, and so my listeners tell me in barrages of email that they simply have not heard anywhere else and they can't get anywhere else. And that is what we do on this show. So we have a big show planned for you today. We're going to talk a little bit about the NFL. I'm not going to beat a dead horse. I'm going to bring some points to light and a much bigger point that really almost no one, if anyone, is talking about anywhere in the media, on any strand of media. And I think after I kind of go through the reasoning, you will agree with this much bigger picture. In other words, what the NFL nonsense really signifies. And it's not just taking a knee by some overpaid brat during the national anthem. It's far more than that. And it's indicative of the alt-left. We're going to talk about, I got a number of emails on last week's show where I went over the fiscal health, more or less, of the 10 worst, excuse me, and the 10 best, that is, most fiscally sound states. And I got a number of emails on that. Some people wanted more information. There's a couple of libs out there who sent me emails saying this was nonsense because the stats clearly show that the red states, almost without exception, are doing far better in terms of fiscal health than the blue states, almost without exception. So I have some additional stuff for you this week that I think will put this all in context. And I'm going to give you Doubting Thomas's, you naysayers, on the points I raised in last week's show, I'm going to give you absolute concrete proof of red states doing well, blue states with progressive policies, tax spend, increased regulation, you name it, not doing well. Because people vote with their feet, folks. We have the freedom to move in this country. And what's been happening with net in-migration, net out-migration between red states and blue states is remarkable. Although it has some long-term consequences, which are unknown, I'll review them very briefly for you, too. I'm going to be talking about this tax bill that is starting to percolate through Congress. Maybe percolate is the wrong word because Congress right now is kind of like a percolator without the percolating parts. it's just pathetic. It is just pathetic. I'm not sure who is more pathetic, the Republicans or the Democrats. I guess I'd have to opt for the Republicans because they have the votes, if they can get their caca together, to put these bills through. Of course, when you're dealing with progressive rhinos, you know, Republicans in name only, like John McCain, that becomes problematic in some cases. I'm not going to go over the details of this tax stuff with you because, number one, the details are going to change dramatically over the next 3 months. I am going to explain to you the process by which something may get passed, and I'm going to just go over some of the really big bullet points, and I'm going to tie that in, and you'll find this fascinating, as to who is helped and who is hurt by the proposals that are now on the table. And let me tell you that that ties right into the extra tidbits I'm going to give to you about the states, blue states and red states, and economic health of blue states versus red states in the segment right before it. I think you'll find it really, really fascinating. And I am going to talk to you about just a little bit, a tiny bit, about immigration. I did several shows on immigration. I've done a number of shows on immigration. But I did one show in particular where I literally went down the states that are most impacted by immigration, which, by the way, also coincides to red states, blue states, and fiscal health. I mean, this is all interlinked. Nothing works interdependently of one another in the modern era with modern economics and modern communications. Every little bit contributes to either the declining or ascending whole of a state's economy, and of the American economy, I might add. And I'm going to refer you to an article which the producers have posted under immigration, and you can listen to a segment by Tucker Carlson on this chain immigration I was talking about last week. I mean, a scary prospect. Particularly a scary prospect if you believe in American values, you value your job, and you value your current level of pay, and or want more, a higher than your current level of pay. And I am going to talk to you about the really big segment on this show is climate change. And I can hear you all groan, oh my God, not more climate change and global warming. Oh my God. Anyway, I have been doing some research on this for a number of weeks. And I've done shows on this before because climate change used to be called global warming until the progressives changed the nomenclature. Climate change, folks, is a political and social tool. It is not a scientific tool. It is nonsense, as I'm going to demonstrate to you with new studies that have just come out, literally in the last several months, by people who believe in climate change. This is not naysayers now. These are people who are warmists, if you want to call them something. I mean, they believe that the climate is changing and that man is causing it. But they went out and did a true scientific study. 31,000 scientists. 31,000. You know how all the progressives get on the TV shows and go, well, it's well settled and virtually all, and the huge majority of scientists, BS. Of course, that's true of most things progressives say. But I'm going to give you the irrefutable kind of history and proof on this. If you want to listen to some of my past shows on this, and this is kind of the period at the end of the sentence of those shows, because climate change is tied into the UN's Agenda 21, you know, controlling where you live and how you live on a global basis. It's tied into all the political nonsense that Obama and his progressive crew and the progressives before them and the eco-terrorists, etc., have tried to spout and mouth off. It's tied into Al Gore and George Soros. Of course, you know, they're in it for the money. They're in it for the carbon bonding. I'm going to explain a little bit about that, too. $12 trillion profit that they like to get their little hands on at your expense. So that is going to be the major and final segment of this show. And, you know, I'm going to start off with a story. A little story. So I had my 93-year-old mom up visiting me last weekend. My son was in town, who, by the way, is a great elk caller. My little sis came in to visit, and we spent some time up on the high country ranches. And it rained, and it rained, and it rained. It was like 4 days of rain, which I thought in the beginning was kind of a bummer. But actually, it turned out that it was a gift, because we got to kind of stay cozy in one of the cabins, and the weather brought the elk out, and the fishing was superlative. And, you know, to see a 93-year-old gal with spit and spunk and vinegar out there in inclement, harshly inclement conditions, in wildly rugged country in the middle of nowhere, enjoying the hell out of it, of course that is kind of her background, was kind of a life gift, you know? And there was one evening in particular where we went out. I took mom out on an ATV, went about a mile back up on a little trail on the ranch, and my son and my sis kind of hiked along this little creek drainage, oh, probably 300-400 yards, you know, off our right shoulder facing uphill. And there's a big meadow at the top of this rise. And I kind of figured there might be some elk out playing in this nasty weather because they love it during the rut. But I didn't really hold out a lot of hope. And, you know, trying to bugle in herd bulls, which are the spectacular big bulls with, you know, 10, 20, 30, who knows how many cows, trying to bugle them in when their harem is set, as it is this time of the rut, is rather difficult. Once in a while, you can bugle in a satellite bull. That's a big bull that got his butt kicked by the bigger bull who has all the cows, but kind of hangs around hoping that maybe, you know, one cow wants a divorce. In any event, we kind of went up there, and it was foggy, and it was misty, and there were tendrils of fog kind of curling in around the canyons and the peaks and wafting over this meadow in front of us. And we heard a bugle. It was kind of down over the ridge. And then we heard another bugle. It was kind of the ridge above us. And my son gets out his devices and starts calling. And did a great job, breaking the trees with branches like a bull would do with its antlers, moving from place to place because bulls do not like stationary bugles. They are not stationary, and if you bugle more than twice from the same position, you're probably not going to see whatever you're bugling at. Anyway, to make a long story short, through the mist, out of the shrouded rain high on this mountain, comes this magnificent six-point bull, and he comes up and literally stands on the ridge, oh, I don't know, 50, 60 yards from us, you know, trying to pick out what bull was daring to challenge him with this bugle. And sure enough, about 15 minutes later, here comes a second bull, drifting in and out of the trees on the opposite side of the meadow. I actually posted something on my Facebook page, and you can listen to that bull's answering bugle to my son's call. Anyway, we got back to the cabin, and, you know, the next day or the day after, whenever it was, everybody went their separate ways after a terrific family weekend. And I got an email from my mom just saying that it was one of her greatest experiences ever. And, you know, you couple that life moment with the recognition by someone else who's involved in the moment that it was a life moment, and that's a really special thing. We all owe each other and those who are close to each other as many life moments as we can create, and that is the moral of this story. Now, let me start off with things which are not quite so warm and cozy. Let's talk about the NFL. So, I'm not going to bore you with all the stuff you've already heard. That's not my job. That's not what I do. That's not why you listen to me. So, I think all of you have a pretty good handle on what's been going on. I do believe that the attitudes of the players who began this travesty, I mean this insane travesty, given the demographics of their primary market, were influenced by outside forces, outside powers. I don't know whether that was Black Lives Matter. I don't know whether it was the American Communist Party. I don't know whether it was sweet-talking progressives spewing their nonsense. I don't know. And maybe some of them were motivated, shall we say, to get some recognition within who they consider to be their peer group and to be cool because, you know, Colin Kaepernick, who started off this nonsense, got lots of recognition, though in the end, had these people thought it through, his recognition was, shall we say, less than stellar. And last time I checked, he's not even warming a bench somewhere. He's warming the seat in his kitchen, eating Cheerios and wishing he was on a football field. Which, by the way, I think is exactly right. But let me give you some little backgrounds on this and then kind of tie it into a much bigger picture. So, the argument that the progressive left tried to raise after this big brouhaha that Trump called out. You know, once again, he called them out of the closet, didn't he? He is so good at getting people to come out of the closet and show their true colors. No pun intended, since this is about the flag. But the progressive left has taken the stance that they have a First Amendment right, they can exercise it wherever they want, and blah, 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 and Trump shouldn't get involved in private business, and so on and so forth. Now, some of you may know, but others may not, or may not remember, that that gentleman who was a quarterback for Denver and later on for another team, I'm not a huge football fan, who was quite religious, T-Bolt. If you remember, after games, he used to take a knee. And before games, he used to take a knee because he was praying. And if you remember, the progressive left, the instigators of the current nonsense, were all over him like flies on a dead donkey, saying how despicable this was and how religion had no place in the game and you know, how he was a moron and blah, 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 the usual stuff. Now we have NFL players taking a knee and directly insulting the anthem, the flag, America, and those who have fought and died for those three things. Those who have fought, died, and been maimed so that these spoiled brats can be on a football field, having never served, most of them, in the military, being overpaid by millions and millions a year, and trying to be social justice warriors. Now, you know, if you want to be a social justice warrior, have at it. Set up a Facebook page, go speak at rallies, I don't care what you do, but you know what? You don't disrespect the foundation of your success. And in my way of thinking, these guys who are making $20 million, $10 million, $30 million, whatever they're making, whatever each of them is making, which in my opinion is too much for what they do, these people, if they want to take a knee in this kind of venue, the only thing which might possibly, perhaps, get me to think they have the right to do it is to see them give all or 95% of that $20 million that would still leave them with $500,000. I mean, how much do you need to live? To the cause that they seem to invoke when insulting the rest of us. I mean, you know, put your money where your mouth is. Skin in the game. I'm going to talk a little bit about that in the tax segment, too. But, of course, none of them do that. Oh, some contribute to this, that, and the other. But I don't see anybody tithing 95% of their $20 million a year to anything, much less these social justice causes, which they're suddenly so concerned about. In any event, here's some little advents. You know, the progressive left tried to say this is First Amendment, and this is this, and this is that. But, you know, over the course of a week, it became apparent that the cheerleading was that the, was the, for the fact that, yes, they were disrespecting the flag. This flag represents, you know, the original sin, slavery, and all this kind of stuff, and social injustice. Never mind the fact that America, as I've mentioned before, is the only country that fought a war to end slavery, i.e. the Civil War. It was 5,000 years behind the popularity of slavery. White Americans didn't invent slavery, not even in North America. That was invented by the Indians. And since I write about that, and I write about history from the Indians' perspective, the perspective of Native Americans back then, with no holds barred, I might add, the poignant, the pathos, the tragedy, the black stain on the pages of American history and how they were treated. The Indians, nonetheless, were the first slavers in North America. Period. A fact, not a surmise. And by the way, the Indians had slavery, per se, after the Civil War, from one tribe to another. So, you know, all this hand-wringing and nonsense is exactly what it is. It is, in fact, a manifestation of the continuing attacks by the alt-left, by the progressives, on all things American, particularly the Constitution, and what signifies the Constitution, i.e., the anthem, the freedoms, the military, and the flag. Make no mistake about this. This is part of the culture wars that are going on. And the progressive left has figured they can't lose on this. If it catches on, they've eroded American values once again. And if it doesn't catch on, as obviously it has not, and fans grow disgusted with the NFL, as obviously many have, and the NFL becomes less popular, its players, its heroes, overpaid heroes, become less popular, then they have succeeded in taking down an American icon. I'm going to tell you another little story. I don't do this often, but I think this warrants it. So, flashback, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, my son was in high school, very small school. I think there were 87 kids in it. And the football team was literally like 11 of the 87. Eight-man football. You played, if you were the starter, you played both defense and offense. You had no time off. And your bench was thin as a piece of parchment paper. I mean, if one of your players got hurt, the freshman who's going to step in for you was going to get his butt mauled by the other team. And eight-man football, for those of you who haven't watched it, is a very fast game. It's not a 100-yard field, it's an 80-yard field. And it's not 50 yards wide, it's 40 yards wide, because obviously you have less bodies on the field. Anyway, the first year my son played football, and each year thereafter, I went to every game. I think in 3 years I missed one game, and that was because I was in Alaska on a long fishing trip, and there was no other time to schedule it. And I drove hours and hours and hours and hours and days to go to football games, his football games. I remember one time I was driving up from a ranch in Colorado, and his game was somewhere up in the hinterlands of north central Montana. And I drove literally, hopefully there's no state patrol listening to this, at about 110 miles an hour. I left at 6 in the morning or 5 in the morning from down there in Colorado. And I drove in and walked up to the bleachers literally as they were playing the national anthem. So I was kind of an aficionado. And you know, there was not a single game that I went to in his high school years that I did not find magical. They played the anthem. Everybody stood. There was wild excitement on both sides of the field in the various stands for the various high schools. The kids were all jazzed up. I mean, it was pure sports. It was pure Americana. You know, the little fire truck from whatever little town it was in. I mean, many of these towns had a population of 500, 700, 1,000. I mean, tiny little burgs, which, of course, is why it was eight-man football. But it was a special night each time they played. Didn't matter which town. It didn't even matter which state when the team got really good and they played elsewhere. Everybody enjoyed this slice of pure America. Small town, neighbors knowing neighbors, good-natured rivalry, indomitable sports spirit, pure. It's pure. And it was pure America. So, when I look at these NFL games, which I virtually never watch, once in a while I'll watch a quarter of the Broncos. Maybe. It has to be a dark and dreary day, and I have nothing else to do, and those days are few and far between. And the reason I don't watch the NFL, I realize in this whole hullabaloo, is that it is not pure. It is America. It is a huge American icon. And as such is being attacked by the left. But it is not a pure thing. The NFL is impure. The NFL is a place where they have rules about respecting the flag, written rules, even as to which arm you hold your helmet under as you stand at attention. And I believe the rules say you will. Everyone will stand at attention when the anthem is played. So it is tough to respect an outfit that is all for money. Because that's what this outfit's for. The NFL is all about money. And the game is kind of the distraction from the true essence of what the NFL is. And I do not cast aspersions at college football, which is fairly pure, or at high school football, which is virtually all pure, or peewee football, which is 100% pure. But at the NFL level, folks, it is impure. And this whole nonsense that we've been experiencing has proved it, unfortunately, in a lot of ways, because it does diminish an American icon and an American value, which is really the goal of the alt-left. When the alt-left's excuses about why these folks were kneeling because of the First Amendment and, you know, black men being killed in the streets, I don't hear anybody mention Chicago where, you know, several thousand black people are killed by black people every year. But where black men are killed in the streets, supposedly, I guess multitudes of them, although that's not statistics, and only by white cops, which is contrary to the statistics, there are more black men shot by black cops than by white cops. Check it out, Google it, do whatever you want. That's a fact. All this is irrelevant to these people. It's irrelevant to the football players for a number of different reasons, and it's irrelevant to the alt-left who is egging on the football players because of all the reasons that you and I know it's irrelevant. Because anything that's anti-American to the alt-left is good. Anything that is pro-collective, anti-individual is good. Anything that is anti-capitalism, pro-socialism is good. Anything that is government is good, that is local or individual is bad. It's really pretty simple. What came out over the course of the week, though, after all these hollow excuses rained down from the various media outlets like so much drooling saliva, what is clear by the post-acts of both people on the alt-left and their comments and by many of the players themselves and some of the teams and owners, is that our original surmise, that's right, you and me, the red states, flyover country, you know, us bubbas, what we thought all along when we first saw Colin Kaepernick kneel, and which we felt with increasing ferocity as we saw the rest of this nonsense unfolding, is exactly right. They came out of the closet. So you have Odell Beckham. I don't even know what team he plays for. Frankly, I couldn't care less. And so he's urinating. This is true. Google it up. And he made sure that everybody knew that he was peeing at the President Trump. His pee was directed at President Trump. And then you have Aaron Rodgers. He's the quarterback at Green Bay. And by the way, the only reason I know that Aaron Rodgers is the quarterback at Green Bay is because I read it. Not because I follow Green Bay. Because I couldn't care less about Green Bay. And he, along with his team and the owners, pulled all sorts of marketing stunts over the last week to try and get the fans to join in the protest. If not by kneeling, then by standing in the stadium with their arms linked to show solidarity. Well, needless to say, that did not occur, and Green Bay got itself into even a further, deeper, if possible, hole with their fans and with Americans in general. There were polls that were done in the last week. They ranged somewhere between 72 and 85%. I mean, that is huge. And these were left-wing polls. One of them was Reuters. They are hardly a right-wing polling group. Somewhere between 70 and 85% to round numbers of Americans felt that the kneeling nonsense was totally incorrect. There was like 60% that said it should not be allowed. And there was another huge plurality, I think it was 68 or 69%, said that punitive steps should be taken by owners against players who kneel during the anthem. So Trump, for all the laughter at him, for his unfortunate use of words in his delivery there, I think it was in Indianapolis or wherever it was, Florida, where he said, you know, SOB, spelled it out. I mean, that was probably unfortunate. He could have said it better. But he expressed what everybody was thinking, and these polls, after the fact, prove it. And these polls are really bad news for the NFL, which is seen, as you've heard on TV and radio and elsewhere, and I'm not going to repeat them now, but their attendance is down. There's a bunch of fans burning their memorabilia. Rush Limbaugh said, you know, he wasn't, and he was a huge football fan, huge NFL fan. He said he's not watching. He's going golfing. And this is permanent damage, folks, to the NFL. Mark my words. They'll get some people back because now they're all standing and pretending that the last week or two didn't happen, and pretending that they didn't say what they said, pretending they didn't do what they did. But you know what? I can't forget. And I have a feeling that a lot of you listening to me and your friends and your family, you can't forget either. So to some extent, people will drift back to viewership, though probably not on ESPN, who's incorrigible. But to a large extent, those that drift back to viewership are going to do so with a jaundiced eye. Because this pulled the NFL out of the closet in a lot of different ways. The hypocrisy in enforcing certain rules and not enforcing others. The hypocrisy in enforcing certain rules for certain players and not for others. The hypocrisy in, I don't know if you knew this or not, do you know that the average stadium, the average sporting events coliseum, if you want to call it, the cost to American taxpayers, local, state, and federal, is averaging $266 million. In some cases, there's been subsidies given to stadium builders, the NFL teams, of close to $600 million. The U.S. military has been involved in funding the NFL in return for certain patriotic things and et cetera, et cetera. When you look at this, when you look at these folks snubbing, by snubbing the flag, snubbing the people who believe in the flag, who have paid for the stadium in which they play and get their overpaid $20 million a year or whatever it is, it makes you wretch. But most of all, you don't forget. So I'm not going to forget. I may not even watch the quarter, the occasional quarter of Broncos football that I have in the past. And though, sorry you golfers, my opinion of golfing is not all that high. There's lots, this little old hayseed from Wyoming can find to do, rather than turning on the tube and supporting an outfit which is impure, and which, when brought out of the closet, has proven to be not as American as it's cracked up to be, I'll be kind, and to be purely about the money. So, by the way, just as a one sidelight, did you know that Colin Kaepernick, right, the hero of the alt-left, the catalyst for all this current nonsense, the unemployed Colin Kaepernick, which I think is poetic justice. Did you know that he has never registered to vote? Look it up. So here you have this big social justice warrior, right? This hotshot with his big, curly, whatever he has going there for hair, you know. I mean, listen, if I could grow the hair, I can't. I wouldn't wear my hair that way, but, you know, to each his own. So you have this guy who professes to be so concerned about social injustice in America, who's has never registered to vote. In fact, he's so concerned about social justice that he wears and promotes stuff about Che Guevara and the Castros in Cuba, which, as we all know, is a, shall we say, outfits that that believe firmly in social justice and democracy. I'm being facetious. And by the way, another guy that kind of brought all this out of the closet, the Spurs coach, don't even know his name, don't care. I'm quoting now. White people need to be made uncomfortable. Unquote. But this is all about what? What is this about? Anyway, that's my thoughts on the NFL, and unless something really blows up, it'll be my last thoughts on the NFL, because we have much more important things to cover on this show. Particularly since I do not have the daily bully pulpit like Sean and Rush do. So let's go to the States. Last week's show, I kind of brought you up to speed on the best and the worst of the states in fiscal terms. And so I went to a lot of detail from the Mercatus study, which is pretty much recognized to be the study when it comes to the fiscal stability of states in the United States. And I urge you to listen to it if you have not. Okay, you very well, since I have listeners in all 50 states now, and Canada, and apparently in Europe too, since I'm getting emails that I need a translator to to translate for me from over there in Europe. These states that are broke, and I got emails, people pushing back on this or wanting to know more information. are almost, the states that are broke are almost all blue states. The states that are doing well, or relatively well, because most states are having some types of problems, are mostly red states. Boy, I got a bunch of blowback on that from the libs that like to troll the show. So let me give you some more information, and I think you will find this proof irrefutable. So the Mercatus Center study was also looked at by several other think tanks, both right and left. And I have posted an article under Economy, or the producers have, under Economy, which you ought to read. It has graphs. It has some links. I think you will find them fascinating. There's one graph. Red states are highly solvent. Blue states, not so much. Another graph. Long-run solvency problems are all blue as well. And then there's some maps which tie in voting to fiscal solvency. This is going to tie right into the next segment, which you will find really, really damning for those who believe that what I'm spouting here is political rhetoric. This particular study, which kind of went off the Mercatus study and pulled in other financial audited matters from the various states, looked just at cash solvency. And they looked at it as two ways. Short-term solvency, can a state pay its bills in the next 60 days? And long-term solvency, can it pay its bills over time, given it, if its current trajectory continues without deviation? And what you're going to find here is that 9 of the 11 states with the weakest short-term cash solvency are blue states. 9 of 11. Pretty amazing. And the other thing you're going to find here is that 14 of the 15 most solvent states for the long term are red states. 13 of the 15 least solvent states for the long term are blue states. Now, this is overwhelming evidence, folks, that there's a direct correlation to political manipulations of tax, employment, regulation, Second Amendment rights, you name it, to the fiscal health of a state. Now, I know some of you out there are still shaking your heads. By the way, the maps on how this country voted, which is also on this article under Economy, they have a map from the George Mason University, which did this solvency study, that shows the least and most solvent states. And then below that, they have another map done by the University of Michigan, which shows the states that voted red and the states that voted blue in the last election. They're not exactly identical, but they are almost identical. So, another, shall we say, bullet point in the proof of blue versus red fiscal discipline. Now, here's the clincher for you. What is the best way to measure whether a state is doing well? It's a healthy place to live fiscally, socially, politically, in terms of freedom, all those, what we consider basic precepts of life, right? For us and for our families. It's how many people are moving in and how many people are moving out and why. So, there is a report, and this is drawn from moving vans, like United Van Lines, you know, the big moving companies. It's also been reported in a number of various smaller regional newspapers. You haven't seen anything in the national press about this, or my previous segment, or my segment last year about the solvency of states. I mean, heaven forbid the mainstream media might bring that to everybody's attention. So let me fill you in, because these are remarkable statistics. And they tie right into last week's show and right into the segment I just did on short and long-term fiscal sovereignty, blue states versus red states. United Van Lines, I'm quoting, reported Tuesday. By the way, this is dated September 20th, so that would have been about a week ago. Reported Tuesday that nearly two-thirds of the moves involving New York households were outbound, a higher proportion than any other state except New Jersey and Illinois. Folks, if you listen to my last week's show, New Jersey and Illinois just so happens to be 49 and 50th in terms of fiscal solvency. New York is in the bottom 10. And that's after it increased over the last year or two. Let me continue. The 2016 National Movers Study by Fenton, Missouri-based United also found that almost 59% of the moves within the eastern United States were outbound. We're talking about the eastern United States, folks. Where were people moving? Mostly to the western states and the Carolinas. South Dakota had the highest share of inbound moves at 68%. I mean, these are remarkable statistics. People do vote with their feet, folks. And I'm going to, at the end of this segment, I'm going to bring this into a really big picture perspective for you as to the political future of this country. There's an economist, Stephen Moore, and he happens to be the co-author of the latest edition of Rich States, Poor States, which, by the way, is a pretty fascinating read. One of the things I looked at when I was putting together the research for last week's show. Quote, every single one of the 10 most liberal states, as measured by voting behavior, suffered population losses over the last decade. Of the 10 blue states that Democrats won by the largest percentage margins, California, Massachusetts, Vermont, Hawaii, Maryland, New York, Illinois, Rhode Island, New Jersey, and Connecticut, every single one of them lost domestic migration between 2004 and 2014. Nearly 2.75 million more Americans left just California and New York then entered those states. Now, folks, how do you argue with that? You cannot. 2.75 million people moving out of just two states, California and New York. And blaming, you know, they also surveyed these people that were moving. And here are the causes that people said caused them to move. Leftist policies, higher taxes, heavier regulation, environmental extremism, labor union favoritism, and firearms restrictions. You don't think there's a correlation here between fiscal solvency, people voting with their feet, the shifting patterns of demographics and population, and politics? Really? Okay. Well, let's keep going. If you're not convinced yet, let me keep going because the rest of these statistics are equally stupefying. The 10 most conservative states, once again measured by voting patterns in the 2016 presidential election, every single one of them gained in net population over the past decade. Every single one of them. And then Moore and this study that United Van Lines did in conjunction, I might add, with all the other big moving companies. They did, you know, they did a compendium. Employment data. The most conservative state, I'm reading now, I'm quoting, quote, the most conservative states also enjoyed a job creation rate approximately twice, not a little bit, twice, 100% more than the most liberal states, unquote. So, you know, you had the American states are laboratories of democracy under federalism. and the laboratory of democracy, by the vote of people's feet, and by the reasons they give for moving those feet elsewhere, is conclusive, irrefutable proof, over and above the conclusive and irrefutable proof I've given you over the last 2 weeks, as to how politics, how progressive policies are detrimental, and conservative policies are at least more beneficial. I find this stuff really fascinating. Now, the other thing that this study went into, and I don't want to dwell on this, but this is really some amazing stats, which all goes back to the same point I'm making. Employers vote with their feet too, folks, not just people. Okay? You would think that if people, because, you know, the progressives, those few that even mention all these studies and reports in the last 3 months, and there's very few because they'd rather it just didn't exist, aided and abetted by a mainstream media that, if it ain't anti-Trump and anti-America, it ain't on the news. You would think, and the excuse that's been used by those few, that people are migrating to because of climate, or because it's sunnier states, or, you know, better weather, or whatever. Well, folks, no state has better weather than California, yet it's lost millions of people. And no state, I will flat guarantee you, because I live here, has worse or a more difficult climate than Wyoming, which has gained population. So much for that excuse. And by the way, these studies, Pew Research Center did a further study on this shifting demographics, people voting with their feet in Europe. And you know what they found? The exact same pattern. People fleeing the most liberal, the most progressive countries and governments and politics to go to a more conservative place. Let me give you some examples so you don't think this is just the United States. Sweden. 50,000 Swedes migrated to America between 1990 and 2015. 20,000 Americans moved to Sweden. Now, that doesn't sound like a difference, but if you consider that Sweden's total population is under 10 million, and there's like 300 million in the United States, that is a huge, huge disparity in people coming to the United States rather than people leaving the United States. Norway, population of 5.3 million, 30,000 immigrated to the United States over the past 25 years, 20,000 Americans relocated to Norway. 30,000 Danes moved to the U.S., 10,000 Americans moved to Denmark, population, by the way, 5.7 million. 20,000 Finlanders came to America since 1990. Fewer than 10,000 Americans migrated to Finland. Again, population 5.5 million. And let's talk about Canada. You remember all these big Hollywood celebrities and all these morons, some of which, not celebrities, because they're not going to leave their pushy-pushy, kashy-kashy places, or their media mouthpieces, which support their cushy, cushy, poshy, poshy places. Remember, they were all going to move to Canada when Trump won the election, and, you know, the American people were so stupid, and they can't live in a country that's so racist and bigoted and homophobic and Islamophobic and whatever, misogynistic, whatever. Well, of course, none of them did. But let's take a look at Canada, which under Trudeau, remember, you know, he's the guy who had it on the show about, I think, 3-4 shows ago. He's the guy who, without parliamentary approval, okayed an $8 million payment to an avowed and admitted, self-admitted, terrorist who killed American troops because he was owed some retribution for having to be in Guantanamo for a few years. So Trudeau is a lefty, lefty, lefty. He's a progressive altar boy. Canada, which has become, unfortunately, increasingly liberal, at least other than the provinces of Alberta and British Columbia, where I know a lot of people and who are stayed pretty conservative. All right, 840,000 Canadians, that's a pile of people, moved to America since 1990. 340,000 Americans moved to Canada in the same period. Canada, folks, has a population of under 30 million, which makes the disparity, again, even more pronounced. And then of course, you have the fascist left totalitarian terror regimes of Venezuela, Cuba, and North Korea. You can't move in unless they happen to capture you because you're a student. And they don't let you leave. In fact, they try and kill you if you leave. So, unfortunately, we have no records from them. So, I think that is, those stats are just remarkable. Now let's talk about tax. So I'm not going to get into the specifics of the current tax proposal. First of all, your eyes will glaze. Second of all, they're going to change dramatically because this tax bill has to wind its way through several committees. To give you the exact thing. Okay, so number one, you need a budget resolution, which kind of stabilizes the messed up fiscal mess in Washington at what it is. Then you're going to have hearings on the tax bill in the Ways and Means Committee, both the House and the Senate. And you might get a bill to the House floor by Thanksgiving, maybe. So there's lots of hoops and lots of steps and lots of nonsense to go through before you even have a bill that we can discuss specific aspects of. But, and by the way, for those of you who would like to know what the specific aspects, you know, not the big picture stuff, which I'm about to talk to here in a minute, but the more banal of the tax reform is, the Wall Street Journal, just in the last day or two, I think it might have been Thursday, had a really good article. You can look it up, read it online, whatever. And it went into like the nitty gritty of what's now kind of out there getting batted around like a tennis ball between the parties and between the special interests and et cetera, et cetera. But here are some key things for you. Number one, they're going to try and reduce the amount of brackets, that is the percentage of tax you pay, from 7 to 3. Number two, they're going to try and simplify, for at least most Americans, not all, tax filing down to 1 or 2 pages from its current nightmare. I mean, I don't do my own taxes. I'm sure that most of you listening to me either don't do your own taxes or have considerable assistance with doing your own taxes if you do. And of course, you're going to contend with the lobbies for all the CPAs and all the tax preparing places, because if you simplify these forms, you don't need these guys for all that stuff anymore. All the tax attorneys, those poor things, are going to have less work, et cetera, et cetera. So there's some interesting things coming up in this attempt to simplify Americans filing their taxes. I think you're going to see, well, I don't think, I mean, this is what's proposed. So the top tax bracket of the three that are remaining of the current 7 will be at like 37, 36, 38%. It's currently 39% and change. Very little reduction at the top. The next tax bracket, as I understand it, is going to be about 22 to 25%. You know, they're still hammering out the numbers. And the last tax bracket is going to be like 12 to 14%. Once again, they're still hammering out the numbers. So we'll see how all that boils down. And the income ranges at which these brackets will apply are going to be changed too. Obviously, there are 7 now. There's going to be 3. That's still up in the air. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. If you're making $40,000 a year, I assume you're going to be in the lowest bracket. And if you're making $500,000 a year, I assume you're going to be in the highest bracket. But we don't know that yet. And that's something that you should keep a careful eye on. Because if your bracket moves detrimentally to you, then the decrease in the bracket percentage that you pay doesn't mean much, right? So keep your eyes on that bouncing ball, so to speak. Third, they are going to take away a lot of deductions that people currently have, particularly wealthy people. And one of these ties right into the state stuff I did last week and I did in the previous two segments. It ties right into it. I mean, there's such poetic justice in it. I'm trying not to cackle as I relate it to you. So one of the things that they're looking at taking away in the deduction side is right now, let's take an example so it's easy. Let's say you live in like a high-tax state like California or Connecticut. Number one, your property taxes are outrageous. Outrageous. And by the way, they're getting to be that same way in Colorado, which is also on a fiscal downward spiral, if you listen to last week's show, right? The more progressive it gets, the worse its fiscal health, notwithstanding its great job growth. So, if you have, for an example, if you are making $10 and you are paying $500 in property taxes and $100 in state taxes to whatever state it happens to be, then under current law, you get to deduct that $600. I said $10, make it $1,000. That $600 from your income of $1,000. So you're making $1,000, you pay state and property taxes of $600, and you get to apply that toward your $1,000 federal income. And then you get into the weeds of whether that's going to affect your bracket or whether that's going to affect your rate, and none of that is known yet. But here is the ironic beauty of that proposal, which, by the way, I kind of support. Now, selfishly speaking, I live in Wyoming, which is very, very low property taxes and no state or business income tax, unless you're an out-of-state company. So, you know, I don't have those deductions anyway. So I'm speaking from kind of a unique situation. There are not a lot of states that have no income tax, just two or three. Wyoming is one. I believe Delaware is another, and is it Florida? I'm not sure on that. It might be Florida as a third. In any event, guess who that's going to hurt the mostest? Oh, yeah. Think about if you're a rich Hollywood progressive putz or a rich NFL kneeling before the flag jerk living in California or Connecticut or Rhode Island or Illinois. That's right. Gee, did I just name off four fiscally unsound blue states? What a coincidence. Where you are paying, and listen, I know people in these states. I know a lot of people in these states. So this is not made up stuff. Where you're paying $85,000 a year for your McMansion in property taxes, and where you are at the state's top bracket of between 9 and 14% on your income tax, so, you know, you kneeling jerk from the NFL who's made $20 million, California is sucking roughly $3 million from your hide on state taxes, you're not going to get to deduct that anymore. Oh, isn't that sad? Oh, I feel so badly for those leftist rich guys. And by the way, you know, the left is all over this tax bill because they want to stop Trump. They couldn't care less about the country. They couldn't care less about the economy. They're strictly politics and ideology. So they're talking about how this is going to increase the deficit. Now, I bet you if you bore down on that, maybe I will in the future, a lot of the people who are talking about increasing the deficit are going to be the same lefties who have lots of money, who are going to be screaming and yelling about the elimination of this deduction against federal income tax. What do you want to bet? I mean, however much you want to bet, you got to bet. Because that's what they do. So that is a really unique wrinkle in this reform. And by the way, that's a wrinkle which really hurts Trump. Because remember, he owns a lot of properties in a lot of rich areas, pays a hell of a lot of property taxes, and God only knows how many states he pays income taxes in, or his companies pay income taxes in. So watch that with particular interest, if you will, because once again, that's going to draw all these hypocrites, these wealthy leftist hypocrites living in blue states with high taxes and high property taxes. That's going to draw them out of the closet like the money maggots that they are. The last thing that this bill does that I'm going to talk about on a big general macro picture is that it lowers corporate rates. Trump originally said 15%. It looks like it's coming out around 20%, and that's down from its current 35%. Now, the real reduction, I want you to know, is not as much, because some of the deductions, like the one I just talked about, are going to be removed from the corporate tax structure also. So it's not as big a fall in corporate tax rates as you would believe just based on the paying 35% now, paying 20% after the tax bill would kind of lead you in the direction of. However, it is a huge decrease in corporate taxes. And really importantly, because small business generates way more jobs than big corporations in the United States, this flows through to small businesses and what's called pass-through businesses. Those of you who have your own businesses, maybe many of you have them in an LLC, whatever state you're in, or an S corporation, whatever state you're in, or a similar type, we'll call it corporate structure. And in those structures, as you know, and for those of you who don't have businesses, as I'm about to tell you about, if the business, you know, John's Moving and Storage LLC, if the business has $100,000 net profit in a particular year, it files its tax return showing $100,000 profit, but it owes no tax. Instead, the tax flows through to John, the owner of the membership interest in the LLC or the stock in the S corporation. And John pays tax on that $100,000 profit as if he had put it in his pocket, whether or not he does, at whatever his current tax rate is. And there's other stuff that goes into it also. I'm not a tax expert, don't profess to be. I'm giving you the big stratospheric picture here because it's really interesting and all of these things affect you. Even if you are not a business owner, the reforms in this pending and fledgling tax bill will definitely affect how easy it is for you to get a job, move your job, or vote with your feet if you're in a blue state and want to move elsewhere. It's going to be huge. To use Trump's expression, huge. It's going to be huge. Because this tax reform bill also applies a rate to the profits in these small companies that flow through to their owners, as I just explained, of the corporate rate, 20%. And that saves a lot of these people a whole bunch of money. Which particularly in the case of little businesses in almost 99% of the cases, is going to be pumped back into the company to expand its share, to expand its market, and to hire more people and buy more equipment and supplies and sell more stuff. So this is a really big deal. In the terms of the big corporations, you know, Exxon and, you know, Coca-Cola and Motorola and, you know, all the big giants. This also has the same type of impact, but many of them, let's face it, are going to squander it on increasing dividends. I wouldn't say squander it, but rather than expanding their business and paying down debt and other types of things. However, what it will do, because it's going to be coupled with what's called a tax holiday, there's estimated to be, I don't think anybody has a firm handle on, about $3 trillion in profits from these big outfits that's parked in offshore accounts. They don't want to repatriate it to the United States, because the minute, under current tax law, you bring a dollar of that in and you got to pay 35 cents to the federal government. Instead, they'd rather leave it in a bank in Ireland and pay 13%, which is Ireland's corporate tax rate. Or Israel, which I believe is 11%. Or any of another host of countries which are in the teens. I mean, folks, if you had $1,000 and somebody said, if you move the $1,000 to point A, you're going to pay $350. If you leave the $1,000 in point B, you're going to pay $130. What would you do? I mean, this is not like, you know, economics 601. You don't need any PhD in economics to figure this one out. Well, if you can give these people a tax holiday, these big corporations, coupled with the tax breaks on the ongoing 20% rate, so that we're in line with the rest of the industrial world rather than being the highest corporate taxes on the planet right now, right? America, the land of the free, home of the brave, and the bastion of capitalism. Highest corporate rates on the planet. I mean, that makes no sense. But these big companies, if they can take that $3 trillion or whatever that huge number is, maybe it's 4, maybe it's 2, it's a huge number. And they bring that back into the country because these tax rates have been reduced for a temporary time period. And I bet you see other strings attached. You have to use so much for new plant and equipment investments. You have to maybe give 3% of it to whatever community you're in to help with, you know, social programs. I mean, who knows what's going to be tacked onto that in the end. But nonetheless, it's trillions, $1 trillion on $3 trillion, $1 trillion savings to these companies, and they'd really rather have their money in the United States. I think most of these countries, I'm sure there are exceptions, would really rather build a plant in the United States and hire Americans. They're American companies. But on the other hand, they have a responsibility to their shareholders, and that is to create profits and increase share price. That's by law. And if that law is in conflict with tax structure, they're going to leave their money offshore. So this corporate tax rate is a huge part of this bill. And of course, the lefties are jumping up and down. Corporations shouldn't get breaks. That's because the lefties are playing politics, divisive politics, caste and economic level politics, just like they play black and white politics and they play Muslim versus Christian politics. I mean, that's what they do. And because they don't care about America, they don't care if there's more jobs, they don't care if you're making more, they don't care. They don't care. They never have. It's only in the past year or two have they been brought out of the closet so that their disgust for America and their lust for power is on full display. So, we will wait and see what happens with this tax deal, which is going to go through, I guarantee you, a zillion changes, which I must say I don't believe is going to be done by Thanksgiving. I really don't. I know some of the pundits are saying that, but, you know, looking at the obstructionist, who cares, about the American people attitude of the Democratic, i.e. Progressive Party. Looking at the splintering of the Republican Party into the populist factions and the establishment factions, which kind of saw in the health care vote. Given all that, I'm hopeful. I give it a 60% chance, 60, nothing higher, that we will actually get a tax bill, but I don't think it's going to be to the first quarter of 2018. Hopefully it'll be retroactive prior to people having to file their tax returns to 2017. That's what I think you're going to see, but, you know, who knows? There are a lot of balls in the air. You got to see where and how they bounce. Now, my last segment, climate change. Climate change. This is the biggest farce, the biggest hoax, the most insidious fraud perhaps ever perpetrated, other than Obamacare, on the people of the planet and the people of America by the powers that be, by the powers that want to be, and by control and money-lusting parasites like George Soros and Al Gore and Barack Obama and their whole ilk and clan. So I have done shows on this. Like I said, type in the search bar, okay? Type in the search bar climate change. Type in the search bar global warming. Type in the search bar United Nations Agenda 21. And you can listen to those shows. I've been saying this forever. And now we actually have science from people who support climate change. In overwhelming numbers, 31,000 scientists have endorsed this study, which literally just came out, which you don't hear squat about other than maybe a whisper on the conservative news channels, and nary a sentence, nary a second of coverage on any of the other channels. So let me tell you about it. So this study came out in a journal called the Nature Geoscience. And I got a dog barking outside the studio here. What's happening? Maybe it's the drones coming to get me. Anyway, Nature Geoscience did a complete study, and there's been several ancillary studies over the last several months now. You know, the Paris Climate Agreement, which Trump thankfully got us out of, is about keeping global temperatures within 1.5 degrees centigrade. That's about, I'm going to round numbers here, about 1 degree Fahrenheit. Where they before the evil manufacturing industries and capitalism started spewing all these toxic stuff and carbon dioxide into the air, which they say the climate change nuts, which they say began only with the Industrial Revolution. Well, that happens to be not quite the case, and I'm going to get into it, because the fraud involved with the science that's been presented, particularly over the last 15 years, the knowing fraud, by the way, complicit with government agencies who are supposed to be checking these studies and reports, and scientific peer reviews, which are supposed to be checking these reports, is staggering. The real numbers, remember, these studies have now been endorsed by 31,000 scientists around the United States. You know, every time that you hear the lefties on TV or the radio say, oh, well, it's settled science, and virtually all of the scientists, and 99% of anybody who knows anything, it's all crap. Just like the numbers they rely on to begin with, and they know it. The global temperature has increased 1 degree. That's 1 degree centigrade, which is like 0.6 degree Fahrenheit, in the last 220 years, i.e. since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So much for the claims that it's being driven up you know, 1 degree Fahrenheit per year, and we're all going to melt and float away, and, you know, the earth is going to burn up and all that crap. Okay? And this started, by the way, with the Industrial Revolution in Britain in the 1700s. However, there's much more. This latest report, and by the way, there's another outfit you can go look at called ClimateScienceNews.com. ClimateScienceNews.com. It's excellent. And once again, it's not by climate change deniers. It's by climate change proponents who are true scientists who really finally dissected the crap we've been fed for the last 15 years and applied the right standards and computer models to it. And at the same time proved that the computer models, as I'm going to get into, that were used by their predecessors, describing all this havoc and terror and the earth burning to a cinder and all this crap, they went into those computer models and showed where they had been purposely altered to come up with those it's breathtaking, the fraud that's been uncovered here. Breathtaking. All right. So, let me get into some details here because it's really kind of fascinating. I'm going to try and stay out of the weeds for you. So, the IPCC, the International blah, 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 is kind of the outfit that, along with the NOAA and some aspects of NASA and some other outfits from other countries, they are really kind of the stalwarts of scientific evidence, the keepers of the supposed bastion of climate knowledge, and supposedly the watchdogs on the accuracy of all these studies, projections, etc., which have been fed to us by left-wing media, by money grubbers such as Al Gore and George Soros, by ideologues such as Barack Obama and who knows who else, I'll call her a minister because it's more sinister. The last minister of the EPA, thank God she's gone. It's just not the case. It's just not the case. Quote, the paper, this is the study, concedes that it is now almost impossible that the doomsday predictions made in the last IPCC assessment report of a 1.5 degrees Celsius warming above pre-industrial levels by 2022, that's 5 years from now, folks, will come true. I quote, one researcher from the alarmist side of the argument, not the skeptical one, has described the paper's conclusion as breathtaking in its implications. He's right. The scientists who've written this paper are not climate skeptics. They are long-standing warmists, implacable foes of climate skeptics, and they're also actually the people responsible for producing the IPCC's carbon budget. That's a remarkable statement and remarkable backing for what this study revealed. So let me tell you what this study revealed, because this is kind of I wouldn't say it's the final nail in the climate change manufactured hysteria coffin, but it's sure a big spike on all four corners. You know, there's been a lot of political capital and a lot of capital money invested in all this false climate change nonsense for two decades, folks. So unwinding this completely, getting the final nail in the climate change coffin. And I want you to understand, I'm not saying there's not climate change. There is climate change. A portion of it, who knows how much, is related to man. But what I am saying, and what this study now bears out, is that all the prior studies, which showed climate change was only by man and only since the Industrial Revolution and yada, 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 and the world's going to come to an end, and run for your shelters and get your oxygen masks and live in your bunkers, and Chicken Little, the sky is going to fall, is BS. And they knew it was BS because they permanently and they purposefully and they intentionally altered the logarithms in their computer, as I'm about to show you, and the data input to come up with this alarmist nonsense. And these guys, who are climate change advocates, have discovered it, and thank God they are first scientists and humans, and secondly, ideologues. So, this fake science is now exposed, and it's exposed in such a way that it can't be argued with. It's exposed by a number of outfits, now signed on to by 31,000 scientists around the globe who have reviewed it, a real peer review. And there's another article. I have a terrific article on this. It's pretty long, like 11 pages, which just came out. I believe it came out on, I think just in the last week, and the study was just completed very recently. And there's many links in this article. It's under economy. And, I mean, you'll know which article it is meaning because it talks about climate change, etc. You might want to read that article, and you might want to click on some of the really terrific links that they have in there going back 15, 20 years. I mean, they kind of reference everything. It's very, very, very impressive. Anyway, there was a book called The Real Global Warming Disaster. It was written by a guy by the name of Christopher Booker. It was published by Continuum in 2009. And there's also an audio book if you want to get it from Audible. And I recommend this book. So Booker is the guy who, his research led to this report, which has now blown the lid off all this stuff. I'm going to read you just a portion of this. And this is from Booker's book. Nothing alerts us more to the curious nature of the global warming scare than the peculiar tactics used by the IPCC to promote its orthodoxy, brooking no dissent. More than once in its series of mammoth reports, the IPCC had been caught out in very serious attempts to rewrite the scientific evidence. The most notorious instance of this was the extraordinary prominence it gave in 2001 to the so-called hockey stick graph, mysteriously produced by a relatively unknown young U.S. scientist, which completely redrew the accepted historical record by purporting to show temperatures in the late 20th century having shot upwards to a level far higher than had ever been known before. Although the hockey stick was instantly made the central icon of the IPCC's cause, it was within a few years to become one of the most comprehensively discredited artifacts in the history of science. Let me take a break here because I'm going to read you another couple of paragraphs. The hockey stick, and I reported on this before. Once again, you'll find it if you search the archives. But there was a bunch of scientists at Oxford, and they were found out to be complete frauds, along with some others that they had collaborated with in their papers. A collaboration being an academic term, not a sinister term, by the way. And the hockey stick is, envision a hockey stick. If you hold it out at arm's length, you got the part that hits the puck at the bottom, which is pretty flat, and then you got the hockey stick coming up at a steep angle. So all this nonsense, this fake science, was relegated to the term hockey stick because it showed, you know, thousands of years of this stable temperature, that's the bottom of the hockey stick, and then this huge increase, particularly in the next 10 years when we were all going to drown from the melted icebergs and the polar bears were going to die and, you know, we'd all be wearing oxygen masks or whatever. Maybe we'd be dead, extinct, who knows. And that represented the 20th century and particularly the current part of the 21st century. So that's a little aside for you. So you know what he's talking about here. Let me continue. Quote, Similarly called into serious doubt was the reliability of some of the other temperature figures on which the IPCC based its case. Most notably, these included those provided by NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, GISS, run by Dr. James Hansen, Al Gore's, listen to this folks, Al Gore's closest scientific ally, which were one of the four official sources of temperature data on which the IPCC relied. These were shown to have been repeatedly adjusted to suggest that temperatures had risen further and more steeply than was indicated by any of the other three main data sources. Continuing, out of the blue in 1998, Britain's leading science journal, Nature, long supportive of warming orthodoxy, published a new paper on global temperature changes over the previous 600 years back to 1400. Its chief author was Michael Mann, a young physicist turned climate scientist at the University of Massachusetts, who had only completed his PhD 2 years before. In 1999, he and his colleagues published a further paper, based only on North America, but extending their original findings over 1,000 years. They also developed, folks, the current study and Booker's book. They also developed, imagine this, the computer system that took all this information, which they adjusted and selectively inputted, to give certain weights to certain parts of it, to come up with, you guessed it, the hockey stick. Huh. Amazing. So radical, I'm continuing to read here. As would eventually emerge, there were several very odd features about Mann's new graph, soon to be known as the hockey stick because of its shape. But initially, none might have seemed odder than the speed with which this obscure study by comparatively unknown young scientists came to be taken up seriously as a new orthodoxy. So radically did the hockey stick rewrite all the accepted versions of climate history that initially it had carried all before it, leaving knowledgeable experts stunned. It was not yet clear quite how Mann had arrived at his remarkable conclusions, precisely what data he had used or what methods the IPCC had used to verify its findings. The sensational new graph, which the IPCC made the centerpiece of its report, had been sprung on the world out of left field. Yeah, I don't think he meant that, but that's a pretty good pun. Left field. Yep, I like that. Over the years that followed, a number of experts from different fields began to subject Mann's two papers to careful analysis. Some rather serious questions came to be asked for the basis of his study. Although Mann and his colleagues had recited other evidence for their computer modeling of historical temperatures, it became apparent that they had leaned particularly heavily on the proxy data, that means kind of indirect data, folks, provided by a study 5 years earlier of tree rings in ancient bristlecone pine trees growing on the slopes of California's Sierra Nevada mountains. These proxies were then used by them to calculate temperature and consist of data other than direct measurement. According to Mann, these bristlecone pines have shown significantly accelerated growth in the years after 1900. As was made clear by its title, Detecting the Aerial Fertilization Effect of Atmospheric CO2 Enrichment in Tree Ring Chronologies, it had been to measure the effect of trees' growth rate of the 20th century increase in CO2 levels. Remember that trees, folks, they bring in CO2. They produce oxygen. Transpiration. That is how they grow, do nutrients, all that kind of stuff to make it, like, really simple. Tree rings are a notoriously unreliable reflector of temperature changes because they are chiefly formed only during one short period of the year, and cannot therefore give the full picture. This 1993 study of one group of trees in one untypical corner of the U.S. seemed remarkably flimsy basis on which to base an estimate of global temperatures going back 1,000 years. Then it transpired that in order to show the 20th century section of the graph, the terrifying upward flick of temperatures at the end of the hockey stick, spliced in with the tree ring data, had been a set of 20th century temperature readings as recorded by more than 2,000 weather stations, etc., etc., etc. The conclusion of both this study, the book I was referring to, and the three ancillary studies, all of them from climate change advocates, not skeptics, all come down to a basic point. I quote, "The IPCC stance on global warming was guided more by policymakers and politicians than by scientists." Who would have thought, right? Who would have thought? Anyway, there was another study that was done on man's hockey stick study. And they found that, whether evidence was taken from lake sediments or ice cores, glaciers in the Andes, or boreholes in every continent, the results have been remarkably consistent in confirming the familiar view, that is, the view prior to this hockey stick nonsense that the leftists glommed onto, was right. There had been a little ice age across the world. There had similarly been a medieval warm period. Furthermore, a mass of data confirmed that the world was even warmer in the Middle Ages than it was in 1998. Imagine that, folks. The first comprehensive study to review this point was published in January 2003 by Dr. Willie Soon and his colleague, Dr. Sally Belenius, of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. They examined 140 expert studies of the climate history of the past 1,000 years based on every kind of data. Some had given their findings only in a local or regional context. Others had attempted to give a worldwide picture. But between them, these studies had covered every continent. The question the two researchers had asked of every study was whether or not it showed a discernible climate anomaly at the time of, one, the Little Ice Age, and, two, the medieval warm period, and, three, whether it had shown the 20th century to be the warmest time in the millennium. Their conclusion, listen to this carefully, their conclusion was unequivocal. Only two of the studies out of 140 that they looked at had not found evidence for the Little Ice Age. Only seven of the 140 studies had denied the existence of a medieval warm period. 116 of the studies had confirmed it. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. The conclusion, by the way, of Soon and Belenius in this report, this separate report, was, quote, "Across the world, many records reveal that the 20th century is probably not the warmest, nor a uniquely extreme climatic period of the last millennium," unquote. Now, folks, I think you know a little bit about Harvard. I don't think that Harvard is a right-leaning university with right-leaning academians. Then there was another study that kind of emerged. This was not by climate. This is really interesting. I mean, this shows the intentional fraud that has been committed on the planet and the United States, costing us trillions, folks, trillions. And when I say us, I'm talking about us bubbas, because the elite get rich off it, and they garner power off it, and they make money off it. The carbon bond market, and I've talked about this before, and I talked a little bit about it earlier in the show. The carbon bond market, that is where you have to pay to emit this carbon, which these intentionally fraudulent studies say are the main precipitators to global warming, is worth an estimated $12 trillion. Do you know who two of the biggest owners in that carbon market are? George Soros and Al Gore. Imagine that. Anyway, this other study, I mean, I'm giving you all sorts of information here. The name of this study, once again, you can Google it up. This is by Canadians, hardly a lefty group. It was published in October of 2003. Its authors were S. McIntyre and R. McKittrick. Good Canadian names. Quote, corrections to the Mann et al., that's the guy who came up with the hockey stick thing, 1998 proxy database, and Northern Hemispheric Average Temperature Series, Energy Environment 14752771. This is all science stuff, and I'm not a scientist, but I'm trying to give you a feel for suddenly how much. This isn't a single report by a single guy who has been a climate. This is a number of reports, the largest and most comprehensive of which, in other words, looked at everything rather than some of these other reports I'm giving you examples of, which are looking at various aspects of it, endorsed by 31,000 scientists around the planet and compiled by people who are climate change advocates. This is a huge deal. You have no idea how beneficial and what the beneficial effects are to you, your lifestyle, your liberties, and your pocketbook in the coming years. You have no idea. Because climate change was the club under which globalism was to emerge. Listen to my show on Agenda 21. Okay, let me continue. Stephen McIntyre, who began their study, was a financial consultant and a statistical analyst specializing in the minerals industry. He was later joined by Ross McKittrick, a professor of economics at Guelph University. Neither made any pretensions to being a climate scientist, but where they did have considerable expertise was in knowing how computers could be used to play around with statistics. They were also wearily familiar with people using hockey stick-like curves, showing an exaggerated upward rise at the end to sell a business prospect or to prove some tendentious point in economics. Intrigued by the shape of the IPCC's now famous hockey stick graph, in the spring of 2003, McIntyre approached Mann, remember the kid who did the hockey stick thing that all the lefties glommed onto, that all the international agencies held up as their poster child, approached Mann and his colleagues to ask for a look at their original data set. After some delay, Mann, quote, arranged a provision of a file which was represented as the one used, unquote, for his paper. But it turned out to not include, quote, most of the computer code used to produce the results, unquote. This suggested to McIntyre, who was joined later that summer by McKittrick, that no one else had previously asked to examine it, as should have been required both by peer reviewers for the paper published in Nature, that's Mann's paper, the hockey stick paper, and above all by the IPCC itself, the international watchdog, to make sure all the science is correct. I added that international watchdog part. They quote sources here. Ross McKittrick's paper cited What is the Hockey Stick Debate About? 2005, evidence to the House of Lords Committee on Economic Affairs, The Economic Climate Change, Volume 2, Evidence 2005, David Holland, Bias and Concealment in the IPCC Process, The Hockey Stick Affair and Its Implications, 2007. I can go on and on. When McIntyre fed the data into his own computer, he found, listen to this, folks, it did not produce the claimed results. It did not show the hockey stick, folks. At the heart of the problem was what was known as the principal component analysis, a technique used by computer analysts to handle a large mass of data by averaging out its components, weighting them by their relative significance. One of the first things McIntyre discovered was that, quote, the principal component analysis, unquote, used by Mann could not be replicated. And, quote, in the process of looking up all the data sources and rebuilding Mann's data set from scratch, unquote, he discovered, quote, quite a few errors concerning location labels, use of obsolete additions, unexplained truncations of various series of data, etc., For instance, data reported to be from Boston, Massachusetts, actually turned out to be from Paris, France. Central England temperature data have been truncated to leave out its coldest period, etc., etc. I continue. But the real problem lay with the principal component analysis itself. It turned out that an algorithm had been programmed. I'm going to use the word purposely and intentionally and knowingly programmed, folks. That's my interjection, my editorial interjection. Had been programmed into man's computer model, which mined for hockey stick shapes whatever data was fed into it. As McKittrick was later to explain, quote, had the IPCC actually done the kind of rigorous review they boast of, they would have discovered that there was an error in a routine calculation step, principal component analysis, that falsely identified a hockey stick shape as the dominant pattern in the data. I continue. The flawed computer program can even pull out spurious hockey stick shapes from lists of trendless randomless numbers. That's from the House of Lords evidence, by the way, folks. As a test of their hypothesis and a support for their paper, using man's actual computer algorithm, which I just kind of explained to you briefly, quote, the two men fed a pile of random and meaningless data, called red noise, into the computer 10,000 times. That's 10,000 times they repeated the experiment, folks. More than 99% of the time, the graph which emerged bore a hockey stick shape. They found that the replication of man's method failed, quote, all basic tests of statistical significance, unquote. Now, I can go on and on because I find this whole thing, I find the uncovering of this climate change fraud, which I and others have jumped up and down about without denying there is climate change. But I and others have jumped up and down about this for years, and we've had, I mean, there's people who have threatened climate deniers with jail and investigation, and I mean, it's just unbelievable. Barack Obama wanted to turn a $20 trillion, $16 trillion economy into an $8 trillion economy, i.e. the United States, based on this nonsense. The Paris Accord was signed based on this nonsense. The original meeting of all the countries in which George Bush Sr. signed in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, in 1993, the Agenda 21 totalitarian, scary document of the United Nations, all this stuff has flowed from this knowing fraud that is now being uncovered and dissected and relegated to the trash bin it originally deserved by study after study after study, endorsed by tens of thousands of scientists, and written by people who are climate change advocates, not skeptics. This is huge, and this is like a snowball effect. The more study that is done, the more problems that are found with the hockey stick, the whole hockey stick impending doom syndrome, on which the powers that be, the alt-left elitists, the eco-terrorists, have undermined, subverted, and sabotaged the economy and commerce of the United States, and really the whole world, and diminished every human being's freedoms on the planet, using as an example, using as the battering ram of what their actual ultimate goal was. How's that? This is a huge deal. I really encourage you to read this article, which is posted under Economy, and to click on some of the links. I think I've given you a good overview of it. I'm sorry that I read portions of it, but I really think in this case, which is unusual, their writing was so concise and focused, it's better than any explanation I could have given you. Anyway, the hockey stick paranoia. The earth is going to be turned into a cinder. The polar bears are going to die. We're all going to be, you know, crispy critters of victims of climate change. And our children are going to die horrible deaths. And the planet's going to spin off. Whatever the nonsense was, is now decidedly, completely shown to be A, fake science. B, one of the biggest frauds ever attempted to be perpetrated on mankind ever. And C, a product of the alt-left progressives. I urge you to read the article and to click on some of the links. If you're like me, you will find it fascinating, and it will bring you in all sorts of other directions. There's a million things to read out here. So the next time you're in a room with somebody who goes, oh, you don't believe in climate change, blah, 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 you can say, no, let me tell you a story. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. You have a great week. We'll talk at you next week.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.